listening to a Right on Radio podcast exclusive with Annie Harview. Let's dig in. Amitava, welcome to KFAI.
Thank you. I'm so delighted. You have no idea, but I used to go to school at University of Minnesota. I had friends who worked at KFAI, so this is very exciting for me.
I love to hear that full circle story. Everyone, this is Amitava Kumar, the author of A Time Outside This Time and many other novels. Here's a Minneapolis reunion for him, I guess, via Zoom.
Yes, very much so.
Could you start by kind of describing A Time Outside This Time for those who perhaps haven't had a chance to read it yet?
Yes. Our narrator is a writer. He's on an island in Italy on a cushy fellowship, and he wants to write about the news. In fact, he wants to write about fake news. And he starts doing work, but then the news of the pandemic arrives. And along with the pandemic, of course, there's also the sense that there is an infodemic, that the WHO has declared an infodemic, kind of an epidemic or pandemic of false information. So the book really is an investigation into truth. It's also a meditation on what to do, what should fiction do when we are surrounded by that fiction called fake news. Does that sound a fair summary?
Yes, I think that was an excellent way to kind of cohere the primary themes. And something that I want to ask about, just immediately jumping off that, is this book belongs to a tradition of works in which the narrator is not the author, but shares certain qualities with the author, shares a name with the author, shares certain occupational or circumstantial details with the author, which I thought was a fun little play for a book that is about misinformation or false information. How did you choose the sort of distance?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would think that because I am messing with this idea of whether it is me or not me, mm-hmm. Because there are so many references to the real world, events, things happening. We are in real time, it seems. I just wanted to keep my reader alert and maybe even a little bit skeptical to think, let me check this. In fact, at one place, I think I have managed to have my narrator say, why don't you Google this, to the reader, something like that. So it's a desire to promote a certain kind of skepticism.
Yeah.
Because I think that is the alertness we want in our citizenry today.
Yeah.
You don't want to quickly accept. You don't want to be the gullible consumers of news. You want actually to be a critical consumer of news, which is the role of KFAI, I think.
Yeah.
So I chose, in some ways, let me put it this way. Vladimir Nabokov, when he, his memoir called Speak Memory, parts of it were published in the New Yorker as fiction, but it was a memoir. And then it was published as a book, as a memoir. So he was messing with people's expectations. And I don't know what his context was, but in my case, at the current moment, this was not such a coy ploy. Mm-hmm. It was more about just promoting a certain alertness in the reader, thinking, is this also true? Well, let me check it out, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's so interesting with the Nabokov. I love the book Speak Memory. I think it's absolutely excellent. And the idea that Nabokov, as an author who plays with perspective so much, like so many of his books, like Lolita and Sebastian Knight and stuff, really do the old narratorial twist where you're given someone's perspective. And then towards the end of the book, it just flips on its head and you see that the person is actually quite scary or quite biased or something like that.
Yes. In fact, because you seem to know his work so well. I just want to very quickly confess then, before you accuse me, that I also that I also stole something from him. If, you know, in Speak Memory, there is a something, there's a little section where he's sort of says, for someone who thinks, for you, for that reader who thinks that I am sorry for the rubles I lost or something like that, you know, because his property was taken over by the revolutionaries, he says, you know, he showers that kind of putative reader with contempt. And he says, but, and then he has a little riff, and then he says, and now the reader may go on or something like that. And so borrowing from him, borrowing is the wrong word, you know, just stealing from him, I said, I have said somewhere in my book that, you know, the reader might wish to skip the next chapter, because of what I have done is just, once this fall, all kinds of news started flooding in during the pandemic, I thought, let me just have a chapter about the news, just listed down some things. It's called The Velocity of Lies. So I say, in an Abakovian gesture, I say, for those interested only in the story, I say slightly contemptuously, for those interested only in the story, please skip this part. But for those other more sophisticated readers like Annie, please read on this chapter, you know, so.
Yeah. And you even reference in the book the kind of the dichotomy between an kind of an Ezra Pound style thinker of literature about literature is entirely separate from the news. Literature is its own thing versus kind of the sort of thing you're doing with this project, a kind of more immersive, the skills that you use to unpack and create and process good literature can also be useful in terms of news and unpacking skills in the world.
Yes, part of it came from just understanding how the word novel from the Latin novellus applies to news, to whatever is new, it applies to news and also to the novel. And of course, then we had the phenomenon of the novel coronavirus, right?
Yeah.
So I was thinking also, of course, I had read a study which said that humans spread lies 6 times faster than true news on social media. Ooh. So I was interested in, and when I wrote to the researchers, they were from MIT. Why is this so? They said probably because, you know, their understanding was that bots, their research had shown that bots spread fake news and true news, both. But they spread, bots spread it at the same rate, but humans spread fake news 6 times faster than what is just plain true news. So I asked them why, and the guy wrote back to say, because fake news is novel. And I was like, WTF, I am writing a novel.
I'm right here.
This is much better than what someone, it's fake news, but you know, so it becomes a little bit of a meditation. While some people like Pound were thinking probably of something, literature that stays eternal.
Yeah.
I was interested in what is it in the present moment that makes one kind of fiction so appealing to people, and by fiction, I mean fake news, so appealing to people or to a certain subset of people. And what must this other fiction called literary fiction do in order to also engage people's attention?
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely sure about my answer, but I think I'm trying to say that you have to slow jam the news.
Yeah. While we're on that topic, can you just describe, I love the phrase slow jamming the news and how it repeated in this book, but can you describe slow jamming the news a little?
Well, again, I'm sorry that you have brought out all my confessional streak here, Annie. that's another thing I stole. I stole that from Jimmy Fallon. You know, oh my God.
This is just, what if I brought you here to dox you?
Yes, I know. Oh my God. It has to do something. I think you have introduced me. I think this has become easy for me to do this because of the whole Minnesota connection. It's like returning to my youth, all the mistakes, remembering with guilt, all my misdemeanors. So Jimmy Fallon, you know, he, I don't know whether you've ever watched, you must watch a video, for example, of Jimmy Fallon slow jamming the news with Obama or,
yes,
or Bernie Sanders, you know, that sort of thing. What does he do? It just alters, it is both news and something current and commenting on it, but also there is music and somehow it becomes sexy, you know what I'm saying?
Or
at least fun. So what I was thinking, though, was in a slightly Gandhian way. You know, when Gandhi went to South Africa, he decided to bring out a paper. And he would, and I have put this somewhere in the book, but it was, he decided that there should be little quotations from Thoreau or Tolstoy. And he wanted to slow, instead of people reading the news quickly and not even absorbing something that was how the world worked, he wanted to slow it down. He wanted more reflection or meditativeness. Now, I, you know, I'm not entirely Gandhian. I wanted my own little speed, but I thought, why not just take something from the news? A man has been lynched in India on the suspicion of eating beef. And this barbaric act, a photo of his lynching, which everyone is familiar with, what if I painted it? And I would slow it down and simplified it, remove some things from the picture. And I thought anyone in India, for example, familiar with that iconic picture coming to my painting, which I've put in the book, by the way, would absorb it in a slower way. And that's what I'm doing with the story itself of the news. I'm slowing it down. And that's what I mean by slow jamming the news.
Yeah. On the topic of kind of slowing down and unpacking the news a little more, a lot of what I love about this book's participation in larger social conversations is that it picks apart what I guess you could call truisms that are going around right now, such as like believe science.
Things that
feel right. And when you immediately hear them, they feel right. But then when you think about it, it's like, okay, but in what circumstances is there a limit to that? And there's a little bite on page 15 that I'm just going to read to kind of bring us into the context before we talk about it a little more. Is science the answer? Not if scientists don't recognize that they too are telling us a story, trying to find their truths by setting up situations. And in the topic of that, in the topic of the fact that science too is trying to tell us
a
story or trying to like bridge from one idea to the other, could you tell us how you chose kind of facts, examples, pieces of science for the book? Because like you and I both know that you could, for example, give a very limited trial of something to people or like hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or something. And it could work in a tiny fraction of the time. And if you present that really quickly, it could be like, oh, great, believe science, this works. And, you know, might be trash.
Yes, Annie, you know, you're so right, because let's think about phrenology. It was the science that told people in this country that you can measure the size of the skull of people and thereby conclude that African-Americans are inferior to white people, right?
Yes.
Science is also always ideological.
Yeah.
It is based in the world and shares its prejudices. In my case, it was not so much simply the prejudice I wanted to point out of science, because of course I'm for science, like you are, I suppose, and everyone, you know, everyone with a brain, but I was more thinking about how to emphasize the fact that these are also stories that people tell or that science tells. And that's why what I did was, I just, over the years that I was writing this, I would just take down notes of experiments that I would come across and think, well, that's neat. The narrator, Satya, is a little bit skeptical of that because he thinks those stories are a bit too, are a bit too neat. He's interested in more complicated narratives or more individual narratives or more idiosyncratic narratives. But so I've set up in the structure of the book, there's the foil to my narrator is his wife, who's a behavioral psychologist. Yeah. So from her, we learn things like the reason why Celine Dion is played on loop in Walmart is because if you're sad and you're made sad by the sad song, if you're sad, you want to cure your sadness by buying things. Uh-huh. And therefore, that's the science behind it. Mm-hmm. And that's, I thought, when I read about that, I thought that was very interesting. And I stole that too. So just to provide you another item on the roster of my pilferings.
The little Target that's in Dinkytown right now is always playing like Donna Summer. What are they trying to get us to do in there?
Yes, yes. You tell me. Yes, yes. But you know, these little stories. For example, I've used the Stanley Milgram experiment. Mm-hmm. Adolf Eichmann, during his trial, said that he was only following Hitler's orders. Cool. So a researcher, Milgram, at Yale, immediately thinks, to what extent will people follow orders if someone in authority gives it? And so he has people inflict pain on others, but he has this person in a coat, in a white coat, saying, go on, you must go on. And so how do people, just doing, that is, in my opinion, excellent science, to investigate under varying conditions, what are people going to do? And in some ways, therefore, it is sympathetic with my own narrator's instincts to go out into the world and see what people do in certain settings.
Yes.
But the truths he finds are a bit more individual, less generalizable, less universal. And I think that is the gift of literature.
Yeah. To dig into that a little more in a specific circumstance, your narrator has kind of a battle with subjectivity, objectivity, when he's been spending time with Farouk and writing about Farouk, who, again, for those who either haven't picked up the book yet or only partway through, he is also an immigrant to the U.S., just like our first-person narrator. But he has a very different class and migration story than the narrators. He got in some trouble. He ended up getting tapped by the FBI for some work. The narrator perceives him as being kind of used by the United States. But as he spends more and more time with Farouk and talks to people Farouk knows, he starts to, not to give away too much, kind of see that not all is exactly as it seems, that he might be getting some sides of the story that others may disagree with, and that also that he too might have kind of been commodifying Farouk's situation or Farouk's story. So could you speak a little to the role that instinct or subliminal bias play, either in this particular book or in your writing more generally, and your narrator's writing more generally?
The sort of twists and turns, let's put it this way. You are stopped at customs. Mm-hmm. You already confronting an official of the state, you're already a little bit nervous. Mm-hmm. The person barks out a question to you. You give an answer that is actually inaccurate and can be confirmed by looking at the document. This incites the other person's both doubt and curiosity. In fact, it incites the other person's suspicion. Seeing that the other person is suspicious, you become nervous and give another wrong answer.
Yeah.
You know where I'm going? I'm going with this. The other person is, the person in authority is predisposed to suspect you.
Yes.
And you, put in a position of power that is vulnerable, mm-hmm. stumble, make mistakes.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in that. I'm very interested in that encounter which is marked or tainted by power.
Yes.
And which leads to mistakes mm-hmm. on one side of assumption, of presumption, of guilt, and on the other side of just innocent stumbling into mistake.
Yes.
And often that can lead in certain situations to tragedy. Someone is being interrogated, someone is stopped at a light, the person happens to be black, the officer is white, mm-hmm. the person thinks this person is threatening, The officer takes out a gun. And as it happened in Minneapolis,
yeah,
a black man simply says, "Officer, I just wanted to say I have a gun." He has barely finished his sentence when he's shot dead.
Yeah.
You know, the case of Philander Castile. Yeah. So I'm interested in how implicit biases shape stories,
mm-hmm,
and lead to results that neither party could have foreseen, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tragedy. And sometimes, and only sometimes, the comedy of human life.
Yeah.
In that particular chapter that you're talking about, there is a student who has been a student from the subcontinent, from Pakistan, who has been enlisted by the FBI in the war on terror. And I had, you know, I wrote a book called A Foreigner Carrying in the Crook of His Arm a Tiny Bomb. And that was written out of my experience of attending terrorism trials involving people of my tinted persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting to see how people had been entrapped because of petty crimes.
Yeah.
But because the war on terror was going on, those petty crimes ballooned into such weights on these people's minds that they easily became collaborators of the state and tried to entrap other innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, someone who had committed credit card fraud would be enlisted as an informant. He would go to mosques and talk to young men and say things that were very, very insightful and involve them in conspiracies. Ooh. This was detailed. And I'm trying in that book to really say, in that chapter, to really say that the state, the powerful state, is a producer of bad fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And we, as ordinary citizens, have to produce our own protective little fictions to guard ourselves against what always threatens to overwhelm us in a moment of bad judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my report.
Yeah. It's also interesting to see how the state's norm or idea of what someone should perceive as important or how someone should set up their life often doesn't match that of the actual person. My significant other works in deportation defense here in Minnesota, and there are situations where they're trying to prove that evidence is real to the state when something doesn't seem right to them, but it's someone's real life.
Yes. So
it's very interesting to see someone's real life be perceived as fiction by someone whose real life looks very different than that person's life.
That's very well put. That's exactly it. Yes.
Yeah. To continue kind of on the topic of narrative and fictions created by the state versus fictions created by individuals. So there's a point where the narrator is overseas writing. He is kind of using the good faith of a friend from when he was young who he uses to get into some situations and ask some questions. And he kind of has a moment where he's like, oh, am I betraying this friend's trust? But also I need to tell the story and I don't quite feel right about what my former friend is doing. And there are several other positions in the book in which the narrator mentions tactics of interviewing or different ways to interview.
Yes.
Could you describe to us the kinds of nuance or sort of different interview styles in the interview process of this book? And how you chose what to include and how to describe it?
Yes. There is a line by Colm Tóibín, the Irish writer who teaches at Columbia, which is that he says that you have to be a monster to write.
Mm-hmm.
When his students express some ethical compunction about using in one of their stories a story that a friend has told them.
Yeah.
Colm Tóibín says, you have to be a monster to write. If you do not want to use this story, then I'll be happy to write to you a letter of recommendation. You can go to law school. Don't become a writer. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard line, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the truth, which is that as Janet Malcolm, in her opening line in that book, The Journalist and the Murderer, declares, any journalist who, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but any journalist who thinks that they are not betraying the trust of their interviewee, or, you know, is deluding themselves. That's what she says. In other words, it's always you're getting, what I'm trying to do in those sections that you just cited is say that I share an ambivalence, and it would be honest of me to express this. I share an ambivalence about the act of writing when you are reporting on other people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
This should be foregrounded, you know?
Yeah.
And so when, what even the strategy of an interview is, or the ambiguous situation that one is caught in, or how you're exploiting a certain contact you had in order to get somewhere.
Yeah.
That should be exposed as a part of the machinery of your production.
Yeah. Right?
I even make a point in this and other books where I try to put in clippings I have, you know, kept it from my notebook, or in this case, tweets of Donald Trump appear in this novel, or clippings I've taken from the New York Times, I've pasted it there, because I want to tell my reader, dear reader, this is how the book came to be.
Yeah.
It's not, there's a material process through which this book was created.
Yes.
It is not some sort of a magical thing. And it was not someone just sitting in the quiet of their room and receiving divine inspiration. Alas, that did not happen. I struggled with real things from my notebook. Yeah. This is how it was made. This was the historical moment in which it was engaged. So that expression of ambiguity, but also pure materiality through which this book came to be, should be a part of the quote unquote education of the reader and the writer. And that's what I'm participating.
Yeah. Yeah. For the setting and larger context of the book, I appreciate that you brought up the notebook, because that's something that I really enjoyed in this book, the way you could see the author narrator kind of dissecting what ideas he finds salient and important, writing them down, kind of looking over things, kind of keeping a more casual notebook rather than perpetuating a fiction that writers just kind of poof, make a great first draft and then it's done. And it was interesting to see, and you mentioned this at the beginning, the author is working on his book at what is described as the Cushy Fellowship. And they're literally on a beautiful island. And he's like, I'm being fed nice food, like I'm like a child or something like that. And he's in this situation where there's this pandemic and this racial justice movement and racial reckoning occurring. And it feels both like the narrator is engaging with the world and piecing clues together, but also that he's like so separate. He's like, again, literally on a beautiful island.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think about how that dissonance contributes or creates to the specific story that the narrator ends up telling, that kind of dissonance?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, let me acknowledge that I was on this in this beautiful place called Bellagio on Lake Como in Italy. So I was literally there and I was beginning to write this book. And I was contending with the rise of Trumpism. I was thinking about how is it best to respond to it. And I also felt a little distant because I thought, my God, uniformed servers are giving me the best food I could imagine, things I did not, and I would, there would be the cocktail hour every afternoon where you, even when I just descended from the stairs, the waiter would already have an Aperol spritz ready for me. So there I am enjoying the high life, and I can see George Clooney's villa in the distance across the stretch of water, and I'm thinking, you know, this, I'm writing about all these terrible things.
Yeah.
But here I am in the lap of luxury. You know, so that was the, in a very real way, there was a starting dissonance.
Yeah.
But, you know, as we realized during the pandemic, luxury, the walls of luxury do not protect you from the pandemic.
Yeah.
In the same way as one must realize that being in the first world will not protect you from the effects of climate change.
Yeah.
That we are in all that we are all in this together, and that globalization is our certain destiny, and that and a world civilization has to confront world problems. So at once the idea of dissonance, and then the idea of walls dissolving, mm-hmm. of crises gathering on a world scale and enveloping everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That too was a part of my thinking. That is, those were the two tensions I was working through throughout. So that the pandemic arrives and the residency is closed and he has to come back home.
Yeah.
And he comes home, but he can't find, which also happened with me. I can't find, there's no chicken. Even there's no tofu, for God's sake.
Yeah.
in the grocery store.
Uh-huh.
No toilet paper. No, and you know, in the midst of the pandemic, a man in Minneapolis is killed by the police in a particularly brutal way. And mm-hmm. a movement arises despite the pandemic. And I wanted to register all of that in the story.
Yeah.
And, so that's what it is.
Yeah. I really appreciated it felt very visceral. A lot of the world events that were going on, like it felt very much like you had recorded things in the moment and then returned to them later. Like, I feel like now there are a lot more kind of flat or retrospective takes on Trump and COVID more broadly, but the way that you nail the uncertainty and kind of churning inconsistency, an example that was particularly funny to me was like the flight where the flight attendants aren't masked and they're like speaking loudly over everyone else. And now we know just like spewing particulate, but all of the passengers are, or things like that. It's just this whole experience of the past 2 years has felt very like, who is setting the rules? Like, it's a weird guessing game of like what you're supposed to be doing. And I thought that it was really interesting to see a depiction that is so detailed and so visceral of like all of those events congealed.
Yeah, Annie, I appreciate that, because when you said the thing about the flat take, in retrospective, what happens is that when we were going through it, everything was so uncertain. We did not have the right information. We were wondering, and I wanted to capture that so that the move, any novel moves across time and moves across space often. But it suddenly moves across time. Time passing is the essential story of a novel. And through using my own journals and records, I wanted to preserve that sense of what was known at that time, what was not known, what was the confusion of the times, what was not. And therefore, language and literature becomes a way of both remembering what is easily forgotten by, you know, the next day or the day after.
Yeah.
It becomes a way of remembering, and it also becomes a way of bringing order into chaos.
Yeah.
Of, that is the essential work, for good or bad, of narrative. A narrative reduces something that is confusing or chaotic into some sort of, it lays it down on line. And I was trying to do that with my narrator trying to make sense of what was happening.
Yeah. And seeing it in retrospect is nice, to have it kind of made concise, laid down in a line, when a lot of it felt very surreal. Like living in Minneapolis last year, it was like I would be laying in my bed at night and it would be hard to sleep because there would be helicopters everywhere. Or like I would go to the grocery store and there would be like someone with a machine gun outside Aldi. Like, what is, and like, I personally was very safe because I am, you can see me, for those listening, we're recording this on Zoom, I'm very white. So like, I was not necessarily the target of things. And I had a lot of freedom in what I could say, the opinions I could express, the places I could go. But there was an element of surreality to like, living in a greater, like a heightened degree of surveillance, a heightened degree of militarization, where like, sometimes I'll remember it like that was real. Or like at the beginning of the pandemic, when we had no idea how it spread and people were like putting their mail in the oven or things like that.
That's right. That's right.
To protect
their
families. And I think that the book captured that kind of chaotic element in a great amount of detail, reality, lived in-ness.
Thank you. Thank you. That was the effort. Thank you.
There's one more thing I want to talk about before we wrap up here. I know a lot of the writing that the narrator is talking about in the book overlaps with actual writing you've done in your career.
Yes.
But the narrator throughout the book references working on a book called Enemies of the People. I went on my little Goodreads app and my little Google, I was not finding Enemies of the People. So could you tell me what, how you picture Enemies of the People? What do you think it's like?
Yes, yes. Very good question. You know, I heard, I think it was a Hulu show in which Sarah Silverman was playing the role of Trump's press secretary. And she would say that these were enemies of the people. Journalists were enemies of the people. And I thought one of the great things that has happened in resistance literature or resistance movements in this country is that you take the oppressor's word and turn it around.
Yeah.
You know, queer, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
So I thought my narrator as a journalist would be writing a book called Enemies of the People. That's how I was thinking. And just to have in the background figures like Sarah Silverman and Tina Fey, on whom I've had a lifelong crush, just as inspiring muses looking over my shoulder. I was thinking, yeah, that's the way to go, man. That's, you know.
Yeah.
And then I don't know whether it is right to have this ambition or expectation. Somewhere towards the end of the book, I began thinking, you know what? The pandemic comes and this guy stops talking about enemies of the people. But hasn't this book really become that book that he wanted to write?
Yeah.
So you know, Annie, you'll have to be a sweet and generous person and say, yes, it does, Amitabha. You can now go with the bold confidence that the work has really happened. But that's what it later occurred to me, that maybe this book becomes that book. I don't know.
Yeah. I kind of had wondered that too, because it feels very much, you were describing like Enemies of the People as a way of reclaiming a negatively connotated thing and taking it to be a symbol of power or something to intrigue people to participate in journalism. And I definitely feel like that's something that this book does. I think this book engages with the problems of contemporary storytelling, contemporary journalism, trying to make narratives or trying to make valid conversations out of the chaos of news and really reclaim that and pulls it together.
That's right. I mean, thank you. But, you know, Trump was asked by an ABC or NBC reporter something about, what will you say? What do you want to say to the people, Mr. President, who are very much panicked right now? This was in the beginning of the, and I'm not even included this book. And Trump said, I think that's a nasty question. And I thought, okay, let my book then be proof that someone inspired by a journalistic pursuit of truth is interested in not being an enemy of the people, is actually doing something that is for the general good.
Yeah.
You know, is exploring difficult truths, not easy truths, not even a desire to be right, as much as a desire to be honest. And therefore implicating himself sometimes in what seems dangerous or compromised. But that, and therefore the expression of betrayal of truth that you had earlier been asking about. And so that is what I was doing over and over in every chapter. And therefore I hope that this becomes a sort of rewriting of the Trumpian condemnation of journalists and becomes instead a little manifesto for the pursuit of truth, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that I could talk to you for so much longer, but I think that's actually a really good place to wrap up. For those who joined partway, this has been Amitabha Kumar talking about A Time Outside This Time. You've been listening to KFAI 90.3 FM. And on the web at kfai.org. Amitabha, thank you so much. This has been such a fun conversation. I feel so lucky to have had you here.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure. I'm truly honored and such a delight to be back in Minnesota in this small way.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.